Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. It's no small irony that a writer best known for writing about cross-cultural experiences, travelogue, and books about cultural disconnect in foreign cultures would write a book about stillness. But for writer Pico Iyer, that stillness is essential for his powers of observation, whether it's writing a novel, composing an essay for Time magazine, or simply restoring a sense of balance that comes with his work that keeps him traveling the globe. Iyer's books include Video Night in Kathmandu, The Lady and the Monk, Falling Off the Map, The Global Soul, and numerous other books. And his latest is a meditation on being quiet, The Art of Stillness, Adventures in Going Nowhere. It's one of the inaugural releases from TED Books. In it, he recounts a saying from his current home in Kyoto, Japan, which translates roughly as, "Don't just do something, sit there." And this, he says, is an important part of every day for him. And through the course of the book, he draws on his reporting from those who share this quietness as a conduit to creativity, from Leonard Cohen to the Dalai Lama's translator to the writings of Proust, Gandhi, and Emily Dickinson. Pico Iyer joins us today from his home in Kyoto. Pico Iyer, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be back here. Thank you, Rich.
You and your writing I've always associated it with travel, of movement, and sometimes almost nonstop motion. When you know, some of your writings, you know, it's not only you're going to one place, you're going to five or six different places. How did you come to write about stillness?
Well, I think if you are traveling a lot, as I have done, as you say, then you quickly see that you need to stay still just to process all that you're taking in. And I think even if you're busy with your kids or you have a consuming job, the busier you are, the more you understand you need to just step back or step away, even for a few minutes every day, to begin to put it into a perspective. And so, as you say, I think travel is kind of how I've made my living, and sometimes I've been orbiting the globe at high speed for a lot of the last 30 years. But the more I travel, the more I need the time to walk back and put everything I've experienced and felt into a larger picture, as it were.
You start the book by talking about an interview with Leonard Cohen. And it was almost like, was this a sort of a eureka moment, or was this something you were already doing in your life or thinking about in your life before you had this experience with him? And if you would maybe describe it too, that would be great.
Yes. So when I was in my 20s, I was living a very fast-paced, exhilarating life in New York City. I had a really exciting job writing on world affairs for Time magazine, and I got to travel a lot, and I had a wonderful 25th floor office very close to Times Square. So really just the life I might have dreamed of when I was a little kid. But even then, a part of me thought, I'm moving around so much, I can't really tell how happy I am. This is exciting on the surface, but is it fulfilling me deep down? So when I was in my late 20s, I actually dropped my dream job, and I moved to a single room on the back streets of Kyoto, Japan, where I had no telephone, no toilet, no bed, really. And I thought, whatever happens here, this is going to show me a different life from my life in New York City, and this is going to teach me about stillness, where New York City was teaching me about stimulation and movement and distraction. So I already had a bit of that inkling, and I think most people sometimes, when they're rushing around and having a good time, sometimes think, well, I should stop and think, is this really what I want to be doing with my life? Is this, when I'm close to death, is this how I will want to have spent my days? And then, a few years later, as you were saying, a magazine asked me to go and do an interview with the great poet and singer Leonard Cohen. So I got in my car, and I drove up into the cold, dark mountains behind Los Angeles, where he was living full-time as a Zen monk, and he lived there for 5.5 years. And so that already was interesting to me, that this great man of the world, who seemed to be able to do anything, had chosen to go on retreat for 5 years. And I spent many long days and nights with him up in his monastery. And evening after evening, he would come down to my little cabin, and he would say, he was then 61 years old, this is the real voluptuous excitement in life. This is the big adventure. And this from a man who'd experienced sex and drugs and rock and roll and known every country in the world and, you know, really seemed to have tasted all the pleasures that we might think of as exciting, nonetheless found just sitting still and scrubbing floors and cleaning dishes, and especially looking after his 88-year-old Japanese teacher and the people around him, he felt that that was his great adventure and excitement in life. So you're right, it was a confirmation of a eureka moment, because here's somebody I'd always looked up to and I'd always taken my lead from. And as a kid, I thought, I want to be like Leonard Cohen. I want to travel around the world and have lots of glamorous girlfriends and be able to be an artist. And yet he turned away from all that for a different kind of life and art. And so that made me think, well, this is a wise man. And the other thing that really impressed me was that when I spent time with Leonard Cohen, even though he was an international superstar, he spent all his time in the monastery, you know, cooking dinner for me and carrying my bags into the cabin and asking me how he could look after me, really as if I was a big star and he was nothing. And it was initially I didn't know what to make of it. I thought, well, this is maybe something he's showing a journalist. But the longer I spent there, the more I thought and found that he really had become completely humble, and he didn't take himself seriously at all, and his main mission was to look after everybody around him. And I thought, that's quite an achievement for somebody who could be living on a desert island in a palace. So it confirmed me in the sense that maybe I should explore this other route of stillness.
You wrote this, you didn't get a sense of it was a false humbleness or a sense of piety of any sort. It was really just sort of wanting to take pleasure in helping others.
You know, I think sometimes I had thought, well, if you go off to a mountaintop and meditate for 5 years, that's a little selfish, because there are a lot of urgent problems in the world. Why are you not tending to them? And when I went to visit him, I saw that, in fact, it was really about selflessness. And the longer he was there, the more time he was giving to everybody around him. He wasn't singing songs. He didn't have any musical instruments up there. He wasn't concerned with advancing his career in the world. He was only literally taking his friends to the doctors and serving them lunch, and he showed me proudly a certificate he'd got to be a busboy cleaning up around the place. And that's astonishing to see a star of that magnitude find such fulfillment in doing the basic human things. And I think the other part that made an impression on me was that I had also sometimes thought, well, if you go to a monastery, that's kind of austere and it's denying yourself the pleasures of life. And what he was stressing constantly was, in fact, stepping away from his life for a little while or for a long while activates the senses and, in fact, makes you appreciate the world much more. And it, in fact, makes for a much more sensual life. Because when I was staying with him, every time a bell would ring, it was a very intense experience. And as I would walk through the pathways at night, I would be noticing every detail. And I felt that I was actually much more alive and enjoying the world much more than when I'm just sleepwalking through my daily routine. And I think that's one of the other lessons he was teaching me, that stepping away from the life is a way to learn to live more intensely and vividly and passionately. And, you know, the other part of the Leonard Cohen story that is interesting is that while he was up in the monastery for those years, it turned out that somebody apparently defrauded him of all his money. So when he came down from the mountain, he was bankrupt. After 30 years of best-selling records and books, he had almost no money left to leave to his kids. And so suddenly he had to start from scratch again at the age of 68. He started making records again. He toured the world for 6 years in his 70s. And his concert tour across 300 different locations was one of the great successes in the world. And he suddenly became one of the most popular singers in the world when he was 77 years old. And in some ways, the reason for that was that he'd spent all those years gathering himself and making himself deeper and subtler and kinder. And when he came and gave concerts, I think an audience could appreciate, here's a rock star who's not in love with himself, who's not trying to impress anybody, who's actually deferring to the musicians around him. So in truth, his life away from the world helped him have much more to offer to the world when he came back. And that's not the reason he did it. He didn't become a monk as a career move, but it did turn out that by being a monk, he was a keener observer, a deeper thinker, and I think he would say a richer human being. And so it's true that when I gave up my job in New York City in my 20s and my parents were really worried and upset about me, and a part of me thought, well, I'm giving up financial security and I have no salary now and I'm giving up the excitement of being amidst these friends. Part of me thought, well, what am I going to do? Maybe I'll end up on the streets. And in truth, once I came over here, of course, life is much more difficult. I still don't know where my next paycheck is coming from. But I never miss New York City, and I somehow feel my life is richer, and even as a writer, maybe I would have more to offer than if I were just racing from my apartment to my little boxed cubicle in Rockefeller Center the way I used to.
Your father referred to that first year in Kyoto as your pseudo-retirement. Was there a big period of adjustment?
Not for me, but for the people who cared about me, yes, because of course, like any father, he sees his 29-year-old son give up a good job and go off and live in a single room in the back streets of nowhere, and he thinks, you know, what? He really worried about me, understandably. But I think very quickly, my parents could see I was happier, I was not suffering in my job. And in fact, I started writing books at that point and maybe had more to contribute to the world than I would have otherwise. And so, yes, for me, there was no period of adjustment because something in me had been longing for this. And I think, again, I'm sure many of the people listening to this program have the sense of, if only I could slow down, or if only I could be away from my job for one day. And my sense is it's difficult to do that. But in fact, many of us have the chance just for 30 minutes every day to take a walk, to sit quietly in a room, to unplug. And somehow that's going to change everything around us and everyone around us. So it's not always possible to jettison your job and move to the other side of the world, but it is always possible to get a break. And I think one reason that I wrote this book now was just the sense, I'm sure you've had it and your friends have had it, that the world's speeding up more and more, and we're living almost at the speed of light now instead of at the speed of life. We're almost living at a pace determined by machines, and I'm not sure it's clear that humans were ever meant to live at the pace of machines. And so I've noticed a lot of people are getting dizzy and we're falling behind, and the more we try to keep up, the further we fall behind. And I think the only way to keep your sanity and balance in those circumstances is to take a breath and to take a walk, to meditate if you're up for that, but just to take a run every morning if that's more your kind of thing, to go fishing, to cook for an hour without anything playing except your music. Because I think it's a safe bet that if our machines are fast now, 10 years from now, they're going to be even faster, and there'll be even more information coming in on us, and I think we're going to drown under it. So it used to be that taking a break was a nice luxury, and I think now for many of us it's a necessity.
In the course of your book, The Art of Stillness, which is published by TED Books, my guest today, Pico Iyer, a journalist, essayist, and novelist, you tell us about a number of people you have visited who have made this a part of their life and how it's affected them. One of the first was Matthieu Ricard. I hope I get that name right. But
Perfect, yeah.
He translates for the Dalai Lama, a very successful, I think it was surgeon or medical doctor, basically gave it all up and went to Tibet to learn Tibetan, and he became a translator. And he says it could be as simple as, you know, he's flying all over the world. He says, I spend my time in air travel. That's my meditation time.
Yes. I mean, I know a lot of my friends were rather disappointed when the airlines began introducing Wi-Fi, because many of us think nowadays, well, when we're in a plane, that's the one time we don't have to think about texts and emails. We can't get cell phone calls. It's the one time we can just, for a few hours, close our eyes, watch a movie, read a book, look out of the window. And, of course, even that is endangered now, because soon there will be Wi-Fi, and we can keep on working even when we're in the plane. But you're absolutely right. Matthieu Ricard got a PhD in biology under a Nobel Prize-winning biologist, and he grew up in the heart of intellectual, glamorous Paris. He went to the Himalayas, he met some monks, and he thought, why do these monks seem so much happier than the people I know back in Paris? And so he studied with them for the last 40 years. And a few years ago, they set up a machine in Wisconsin which could, for the first time in history, actually measure happiness and peace of mind and kindness.
Through various parts of the brain, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, which was activating a part of the brain that associates with happiness, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So what they do is they put a subject into a functional MRI for 3.5 hours, and then they, on the screens, they can actually see neurologically how happy he is and how calm he is. And the first person they tested was Matthieu Ricard, because he was both a Western-trained scientist and a Buddhist monk. And he went in for 3.5 hours into the functional MRI. He came out, and they found, literally, his scores were off the charts. They had never been seen in the history of neuroscience for happiness. And so he quickly became known as the happiest man on earth, and he quickly became in demand. Now people are always asking him to go and give lectures, and that's why he spends, even though he's a monk and he wears robes, he's spending so much of his time flying. But even flying, he sees as an opportunity to just gather himself and to think about what he will do when he lands. And just, I think part of what stillness is for me is remembering what you most care about. Because nowadays, we're so busy racing from one text to the next email to the next CNN update. All this stuff is coming in on us, and some of it is not very important. It's the latest Kardashian update. And some of it is very important. Somebody we care about is suddenly in the hospital. And it gets harder and harder to sift out the important stuff from the less important. And I think that's one thing. We can only remember what's important by stepping away from it. And the other thing I sometimes thought, even as somebody who loves travel, is that when I have a difficult moment in my life, actually I just got a phone call 30 minutes ago that my mother is in the ICU and I have to fly back to California today to see her. And as I prepare myself for that, it's not all the running around and the wonderful travel that's going to help me. It's the time when I've sat still and when I've remembered what is most important in my life that's going to guide me, I think.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear about your mother, and I appreciate your being here today. My guest today is Pico Iyer, a journalist, essayist, and novelist. His new book is titled The Art of Stillness. Now, what do you mean by stillness? Is it meditation? Is it yoga? Is it sitting in nature and observing, listening, just being quiet, or all of those things?
Exactly. And wonderfully said. And I was just about to say all of those things. And I have friends who meditate and do yoga or tai chi, and I really respect them. And I think it all makes their lives a lot richer. I'm one of those people who's too lazy to meditate. I've never meditated, and I'm too uncoordinated to do yoga or tai chi. But nonetheless, I can feel that need, and I satisfy it by, for example, you're talking to me now in my little apartment in Japan, which I share with my wife, just two rooms here. We don't have a car, we don't have a bicycle, we don't have a TV, I can understand. So all of that, even though I'm a functioning journalist, I find the fewer things I have in my life, the freer I feel. Every day I take two walks around a neighborhood, not exciting walks, but just those two walks seem to change the quality of my day and remind me what I should be doing. I try to spend 1 hour just sitting in the sun reading a book, and when I finish reading a book, I usually feel, I can almost feel subtler and deeper and more attentive than when I'm running around all over the place. In the evenings, I'm waiting for my wife to come home from work, and I used to scroll through my emails or check out websites at that time, and now I just turn off the lights and listen to some music, and I find I'm so much fresher when my wife returns home. I sleep better, I wake up feeling much clearer. So just tiny things that you can fit into an everyday life. That's all I do. I wish I could do things like meditation, but if you don't have the capacity or the inclination to do that, as you said, take a walk into the wilderness on the weekend. Even going to the health club to me is one of the highlights of the day because it clears my head. And when I come back from the health club, I'm much readier to go back to my job and do something constructive.
And do you find that it does affect your work for the better?
Very much so, yes. In fact, as a writer, and I've been writing now for 33 years, I find that my best work comes when I'm taking a walk or when I'm playing tennis or when I'm going to the movies. And when I'm not consciously thinking about my work, that's when I get my best ideas. And I think while I was writing this book, one of the things that made a big impression on me was that I would visit Silicon Valley, and I would go and see friends who work at Google, for example, and see how they are encouraged to do their work while playing beach volleyball or taking long walks around the hills next to their campus. Or they have many, many meditation rooms there, and they have a health club on the facility. And, of course, famously, Google gave its workers 20% of their paid time off, just free, because the heads of the company were wise enough to know that it's in the free time that the really great inventions often happen. So I think whatever our job or whatever our lives, most of us know that sensation that when you're staring and staring at something, you lose all focus. When you take your mind on a walk and allow it to kind of run free like a dog on a beach, that's when it suddenly excavates new things and you can go back to your task with a new sense of clarity and direction. And, you know, one of the scary figures that I had heard recently is that there's this new field called interruption science, which is perfect for the 21st century. And researchers have found that it takes the average human being 25 minutes to recover attention after a phone call. It's that long. If when you and I stop talking today, it's going to take you and me a long time to go back to our actual tasks. And yet, the average human being today receives a phone call every 11 minutes. So we're never caught up, and we're always in that speeded up, adrenaline, kind of dizzy and dazed state. And that's why, unless we take conscious measures, we just get drowned under all the information that's coming in on us. In the time that you and I are talking today, the human race is going to gather 6 times more information than exists in the whole Library of Congress. So it's just amazing how much is coming at us now. And we have to do something to avoid losing ourselves in the swell.
Now, out of Google, you came across this term that I've heard other places too. It's called the secular Sabbath, and it's about turning off all the electronics for, say, a weekend and sort of being in the moment.
Yes, exactly. A lot of people in Silicon Valley practice what they often call either digital detox or an internet Sabbath. And as you said, from Friday night to Monday morning, they go completely offline. And that means that when they go online again, I think they have much more energy and they're not distracted and they have fresh ideas to bring to their colleagues and their friends. And it made a big impression on me that the people who know the most about technology are also the wisest about placing limits on technology, because they know that technology can't give us all the answers. And the information revolution came kind of without a manual. I think machines give us so many wonderful things, but the one thing they don't give us is a chance of how to make the wisest use of machines. And in order to do that, you have to be offline and you have to remember what you care about. So, for example, there's somebody called Kevin Kelly in Silicon Valley who writes a lot of the best books about our latest devices. And he writes those books about the most cutting-edge technology without a smartphone, without a TV, and without a laptop in his house. And he often goes for 4 months on end traveling around the villages of Asia just so that he will be rooted in something human. So he knows that technology itself is not the answer. It's just a tool, and to make the best use of that tool, we have to be fully human and not enslaved to our machines.
And really, in a sense, you know, we've come so far in this digital revolution. Maybe this is the next step, is figuring out what the limits of it are and where we place the limits in our own life to remain essentially human.
That's exactly my feeling, and that's why I wrote The Art of Stillness. And I think most of us are already beginning to find their ways. So many of the people I know will go for a run every day, or go to do some yoga, or meditate, or go fishing, or one way or another, do something just so they have some time to themselves. And you're right, because as a traveler, when I began traveling, I thought that the great luxury was to go to have a lot of space and to go to Tibet or Cuba or whatever exotic destination was available. Nowadays, we can see Tibet or Cuba or Tulsa on our smartphones wherever we are in the world and at any point. And what's much harder to get is a lot of time and an open space in our schedule and an open space in our minds. So just as you say, I think we have reached the state of overdose where people are realizing that nowadays there's a thing called a black hole resort, which is a very fancy, expensive hotel. People will spend hundreds of dollars a night to stay there, and one of its main features is that when you arrive, you hand over your smartphone or your tablet to the front desk, and for 3 days you enjoy absolute freedom. And it does require a period of adjustment, and the first day is probably hell. The fingers are twitching. You're thinking, what am I missing? You know, my boss is mad at me. There's some new Lakers score or some development in the world I'm missing out on. But I think after even about 3 days, suddenly you feel clarified and liberated and realize you're not missing anything at all, but in fact, you're getting something. And I was once talking about this, and a young woman called up. I was talking on the radio, and she said, well, it's all right for you. You're a travel writer, but I'm a young mom, and I've got two kids, and I have to spend a lot of time with them. What about me? And I thought to myself, she's, of course, got huge pressures in her life, but if she could just take 30 minutes off every morning and ask her husband or her mother or a friend to look after the kids, she would be so much less exhausted and less distracted with her children, and probably would find that she has a lot more to give with them, and she could be a better mother if she takes just 30 minutes off. And I recently heard that J.P. Morgan, one of the great financiers in the history of our country, used to take 2 months off every year. And he said he could never achieve in 12 months what he did in 10 months. In other words, the more time he took off, the better he could do justice to his life and to his friends and to everything that meant something to him.
You also recount a story about a yoga-based meditation and breathing program for traumatized and stressed veterans that seem to have, again, practicing this art of stillness, whether it's meditation or yoga, and all of a sudden a lot of their anxieties and trauma seems to reduce.
Yes, and again, I think 30 years ago we might have thought of all of this as a little flaky or from left field. But nowadays, congressmen practice meditation in the houses of Congress. And as you say, I think it's an important part of the training for certain, the Marine Corps and a lot of our military services found that this is the way to strengthen and prepare the young men and women who are doing such heroic work, you know, all around the world trying to protect us. And I spoke to a researcher in Stanford who, as you say, I describe in the book, and she brought in a whole series of veterans who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And when she said she was going to lead them in some yoga-based meditation, they were very cynical. You know, these are tough guys and riding motorbikes with tattoos. The last thing they want to do is anything wishy-washy or new agey. But she just told them to do this for a week. And at the end of the week, and then 1 year later, she tested them, and she found that suddenly so much of their anxiety and their stress was gone. And I think the analogy I sometimes use is that a few years ago, I went for my annual checkup, and my doctor said to me, well, you look fine, but you're not getting any younger, so you should go to the health club every day. And as soon as he said that, I signed up for the health club, and now religiously I go to the health club and do my 30 minutes on the treadmill every day. But if somebody said to me, you should go to the mental health club, you should just spend 30 minutes sitting quietly every day, I'd say, no, I don't have the time for that. And yet, I think the inner health club, or the mental health club, is much more important for our well-being and the way that we are with the people we love than just the mental health club. Because if you're really toned and you've got strong muscles, but your mind is weak, you're in trouble. Whereas even if your body is weak, if your mind is strong, you're pretty much okay. So I think sometimes we can be a little short-sighted, and we take great care of our bodies nowadays, but we neglect our minds. And in the final analysis, that's what's going to determine our lives. And I think that's why the military services in the United States have realized that they've done an excellent job of preparing the Marines for the physical aspect of their job. But really, they need mental training to deal with crises, and that meditation or just being still turns out to be the best way for dealing with a firefight or a sudden injury or all the terrible things that they have to deal with on a daily basis.
Now, of course, we associate so much of your writing with travel. You've done Travelogue. You've done novels that involve travel and as a journalist and essayist. When you travel, do you use the art of stillness? Does it help you get a better sense of place?
I hope so, because as you said earlier, I think being still heightens your sense of attention, makes you more alive to the world, makes you think less about yourself and more about everything that's around you. But I think the main form of stillness for me in travel is when I come home. And again, I'm sure everybody can relate to this. Let's say you have a wonderful one-week vacation in New Orleans or Hawaii or Paris, and that lasts a week and you have a rich time. But it's really when you come back home and you start going through your photos and looking over your journal, if you keep a journal, or thinking back on everything you experienced, and that lasts maybe the rest of your life. Really, the trip is mostly taking place when you're sitting still at home thinking about it. And it's almost as if the physical journey is just the appetizer, but the real feast comes when you're back home. So travel is almost how I decorate the house of my life. But stillness is how I lay the foundations.
Pico Iyer, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Essayist and novelist Pico Iyer speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He's an essayist for Time magazine and also writes regularly for Harper's, New York Review of Books, and the New York Times. His latest book is titled The Art of Stillness, Adventures in Going Nowhere. It's a TED original published by Simon & Schuster. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.